our supplies are cut, teacher travel cut, student travel cut, professional services cut, fuel cut.
School board representatives argue for better funding. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, March 27th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a tight deadline for studying the Susitna Dam.
The timelines that FERC mandates in the licensing process don't seem reasonable to get the required studies done.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. The Association of Alaska School Boards believes in investing in early childhood development. It can produce great dividends for kids and our state. More information at aasb.org. This message sponsored by the Association of Alaska School Boards.
The man listed by Anchorage police as a person of interest in the abduction of 18-year-old Anchorage barista Samantha Koenig has been arraigned in federal court in Anchorage on a fraud charge. This afternoon, Israel Keyes entered a not guilty plea to a charge of access device fraud for allegedly making cash withdrawals from a stolen debit card. The card was not Koenig's. Trial was set for May 21st. No bail was set pending a further order from the judge. Koenig has been missing since February 1st. A surveillance camera at the coffee shack where she worked showed her being led away by a man police believe was armed. There was no mention of Koenig during Tuesday's court hearing. With less than 3 weeks remaining in the legislative session, it's looking unlikely lawmakers will pass a bill to reestablish the Alaska Coastal Management Program. A citizens initiative setting up a program has been approved for a statewide vote later this year. But lawmakers could preempt the measure with substantially similar legislation. Kodiak Republican Alan Osterman, the House Majority Leader, introduced a bill that closely mirrors the initiative. But Osterman says he's aware some House members oppose legislative action on the coastal management issue.
We heard one of the sponsors of the initiative on the discussion with one hearing that we had talking about something that works. And so that's really where our goal is, to find something that works and that's acceptable to the legislature. Can we get there? We don't know yet.
Osterman's bill had one hearing in the House Resources Committee 2 weeks ago. A legislative legal advisor testified that lawmakers would have significant leeway to decide what substantially similar means. Before closing last year, the Alaska Coastal Management Program allowed the state and local communities to have greater input into federal permitting decisions along Alaska's coastline. It also helped developers by streamlining the regulatory processes of various state and federal agencies. Local school leaders today got their chance to tell legislators how they are dealing with expected budget deficits for the next school year. The hearings followed the Parnell administration's presentation yesterday at the opening of the House Finance Committee's week-long series of meetings focusing on education. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
With a goal of getting lawmakers to increase local school funding through a jump in the base student allocation, a group made up largely of local school board members presented their case to the House Finance Committee. Teachers in the North Slope Borough have voluntarily taken a salary increase off the table this year, although Board of Education Clerk Mary Sage says it's difficult for the district to compete for new teachers. She said in recent years they've had as many as 50% of their teachers new, and some schools have had turnover rates of 100%.
Remember, we are recruiting teachers to live in the Arctic. When we left Barrow, it was 34 degrees below zero, and that does not include the wind chill factor. I have not had running water for over a week because the main water line is frozen, and there's 45 homes with frozen sewer lines.
Sage says it's hard to convince a teacher to go to the North Slope when California is offering equal pay and $6,000 signing bonuses. Eva Kinevac of Point Hope said currently the principal for the school in her community is in his second year. And that's the first time in 11 years anyone has stayed after the first year. She says the schools in her district are already having problems, and it's the kids that are seeing results of the budget shortages.
There are some things in the villages we can't do, and one of the things is alternative schools. In Barrow, we have an alternative schools, and they reach maybe 50 to 60 kids a year, but in the not only in our region but throughout the state. I think of all the ones that we cannot reach. You know, there's a lot of kids out there that we are missing.
Kinevec says the North Slope's biggest hope was in a state program that provided mentors for new teachers. Unfortunately, she said the program's now been cut from 2 years to one. She said the other big goal is to get increased broadband networking for schools to teach specialty classes. Meanwhile, Kodiak Island School District's board president, Melissa Borton, said the $3.5 million deficit on the horizon for this year will mean a cutback in teachers and staff.
We're looking at a 40-position reduction in next year's budget. 32.5 of those would be certificated classroom staff. 6 of those would be classified to administrative staff.
And Pete Hepfner said the Cordova School Board, of which he is president, is looking at about a $300,000 deficit, representing 6% of that district's budget. He said that reflects 2 years of flat state funding and the effects of 3% inflation.
Our supplies are cut, teacher travel cut, student travel cut, professional services cut, fuel cut, electricity cost cuts. We do not have a head maintenance position at this point in time. We are looking at a reduction of a teacher at the elementary school and a teacher at the junior senior high level.
The governor's opposed funding schools through any increase to the base student allocation. Although legislation increasing money for that formula is working its way through the legislature, the governor has said he prefers to meet special, distinct needs such as energy and transportation costs rather than increase the formula funding. The education focus continues next with a discussion with the president of the State Board of Education. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
The first of a series of scoping meetings for the proposed Susitna-Watonna Hydroelectric Dam took place in Anchorage Monday, kicking off the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission's environmental impact analysis of the proposed 700-foot dam. Talkeetna is the first community downriver from the dam, and some residents are wary of the impacts the $4.5 billion project could have on local river ecology. KTNA's Lorian Nettleton has more.
This week, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission began a series of scoping meetings to identify issues presented by the proposed construction of a 700 to 800-foot dam on the Susitna River. FERC spokesperson Celeste Miller says all public testimony given at the meetings will be incorporated into a draft environmental document, and the Alaska Energy Authority will have to resolve any issues before submitting their formal application in 2015.
We're trying to get as much information as we can on issues that are important and that are relevant to this proposal. And when we get them, we do look at all of them. And when we issue our environmental review documents, in this particular case, we've determined that we're doing an environmental impact statement. We're going to issue a draft environmental impact statement and a final environmental impact statement. In our draft environmental impact statements, we address all of the comments we receive from the public and any party. We address them in that document.
The proposed Susitna-Watonna Hydroelectric Dam has plenty of momentum behind it. Last year, the state gave the Alaska Energy Authority instructions to make the dam happen and invested $66 million to back the project. Rick Leo is a member of the Coalition for Susitna Dam Alternatives and a longtime resident of the Upper Susitna Valley. In February, Leo had a chance to join Alaska Energy Authority's new Susitna project manager, Wayne Dyack, for a conversation about the project.
Isn't it a more appropriate stance for AEA to take to say, we would like to build this dam, but we don't yet know if we can? There were 34 unresolved issues in 1984. There was no license given. There were many things that weren't concluded, and in fact, most of the data your own agencies are telling you is irrelevant now. It's just too old. Too many things have changed since then.
Well, I would argue that it is very relevant information that, yes, things have changed. We need to update that information. I don't think any of us want to build a project that's going to have adverse consequences that we haven't foreseen. We want to make sure we do our homework here and address those issues appropriately.
Jan Konigsberg from the Hydropower Reform Coalition says that the timelines established by the FERC licensing process were streamlined to assist pre-existing dams looking to renew their licenses. The timeline leaves 2 years for federal and state agencies to conduct studies that will be used to inform the permit application, which Konigsberg says is not enough for an infrastructure project of this magnitude.
I think sort of the rub here is that FERC's integrated licensing process, which was designed for relicensing of existing projects, is being used for a project of such massive complexity and so complicated that the timelines that FERC mandates in the licensing process don't seem reasonable to get the required studies done.
The Alaska Energy Authority has voiced its support for a request by the Department of the Interior and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration for an extension on the comment deadlines, which would give those agencies more time to address the issues brought up in this week's testimony. In Talkeetna, I'm Lorian Nettleton.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, celebrating Chemai and Bethel with a feast.
We've got a lot of fish and baked salmon and just all sorts of stuff. We're still expecting more food.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net.
It's been just over a year since a 9.0 magnitude earthquake struck off the coast of Japan. The resulting tsunami devastated Japan's coastline and killed nearly 16,000 people. While Japan continues to recover from the disaster, debris has started to show up on U.S. shores. The tsunami took out the Fukushima nuclear plant, and there have been concerns that the washout could be radioactive. Earlier this month, debris was reported on Sitka's shores, and some was found on Kodiak's beaches last December. While scientists generally agree people should be careful when dealing with tsunami debris, it's not because of radiation. Catherine Higley is the head of the Department of Nuclear Engineering and Radiation Health Physics at Oregon State University. Higley says she and other researchers feel confident that while debris found on shore might set off your Geiger counter, the level of radiation will be negligible.
One, you know, the tsunami, the earthquake happened a couple of days really before any release from the plants occurred. So this material was offshore. So that's the first thing. It wasn't right up against the plant. The second thing is that a lot of the contaminants are very water soluble. It's going to get diluted because of salt water, rain, you know, waves and the like. They're going to wash it off of the debris.
The area surrounding Fukushima might have to deal with elevated radiation levels for a few years, but there's no concern this side of the ocean, says Higley. Higley says many people have misconceptions about radioactivity, mainly that if it can be detected, it's dangerous. She says people should be more concerned about exposure to industrial chemicals. Alaskans in coastal areas, including Homer, will hear a test of local tsunami sirens tomorrow. As KBBI's Aaron Selbig reports, the tests coincide with Tsunami Awareness Week and are designed to educate the public about tsunami preparedness.
Many Alaskans, even those who live in coastal areas, probably didn't think a whole lot about tsunamis until March 11th of last year, when a devastating earthquake in Honshu, Japan, unleashed an even more devastating tsunami that killed more than 16,000 people. That tsunami set off alarms all along coastal Alaska, creating confusion among locals about what they should do. Cindy Preller is the Tsunami Readiness Program Manager with the National Weather Service. She says even folks like her, scientists who study tsunamis every day, learned very much from the event.
We learned that we need to practice more and be prepared because a tsunami doesn't have a season or a time of the day, and a local tsunami can arrive in less than 10 minutes. So we learned that we need to be absolutely vigilant about our preparedness.
That's why Governor Sean Parnell has declared this week to be Tsunami Awareness Week, in part to coincide with the 47th anniversary of the 1964 Good Friday earthquake, which caused extensive tsunami damage in Seward, Whittier, Kodiak, and other communities. As part of Tsunami Awareness Week, the National Weather Service and the Alaska Broadcasters Association will be conducting a test of the state's tsunami warning system. The test will take place Wednesday morning between 9:45 and 10:15 a.m. If you're near a television or a radio during that time, you will likely hear the test. Homer Volunteer Fire Department Chief Bob Painter wants folks to know, however, that the tsunami siren warning they will hear Wednesday will be different than what's heard during the weekly tests that normally take place on Wednesdays.
It won't be the chimes and saying this is a test of the tsunami warning system. What it will say is, attention, a tsunami warning has been issued for this area. Turn to your local radio station for details. Because it is a real live activation signal, that is the signal, that's the message that's programmed into the sirens. So that's what we're telling, trying to get the word out, that if you have these sirens go off between 9:45 and 10:15, it is probably a test.
The Kenai Peninsula Borough has a system of 14 tsunami sirens, with one each located in Seldovia, Port Graham, and Nanwalek, 5 sirens in Homer, and 6 in Seward. The sirens can be activated locally in the event of a local emergency like a flood or a fire, or by broadcast of a tone over the emergency alert system. Painter says the sirens at Homer are very important because they can be activated quickly.
I've been told by numerous experts that we're not specifically or are not very much at risk from these transmitted tsunamis. I believe our most greatest risk would be from a locally generated tsunami, such as a local earthquake or a landslide.
Cindy Preller was on duty at the West Coast and Alaska Tsunami Warning Center in Palmer the night of the Honshu earthquake. She says another thing the public needs to know is the difference between the two different warning levels issued by the center. A tsunami warning, she says, is the most serious, calling for an immediate evacuation.
And then we also have another level of warning that's called a tsunami advisory, which is different from the Weather Service advisory. It's still a low-level warning, and we had much of Alaska was in an advisory status. But what an advisory means is to clear the beaches and to clear the harbors. So it's not a full-scale evacuation.
Once again, this week's test of the state tsunami warning system will take place Wednesday between 9:45 and 10:15 a.m. In Homer, I'm Aaron Selbig.
A California man who lived in the wilderness around Healy has been arrested for burning down a cabin. State troopers say Andrew Costales told them he left a fire going in a wood stove of the private cabin near Dora Creek, and the structure burned while he was out. Costales was arrested in Healy March 23rd and charged with burglary, criminal trespass, and criminally negligent burning. Fish and Wildlife Trooper Jim Ellison says Costales is known to live an itinerant lifestyle.
Has a history of living in other people's cabins out here. He thinks of himself as a survivalist.
Ellison says the burned cabin is on Alaska Mental Health Trust land and was under lease to the Healy Fire Department. It's not the first time the 23-year-old Costales, a self-described prospector, has had contact with state troopers. Ellison says Costales was rescued from another remote area cabin in November.
He hit the SOS button on his spot tracker, and Trooper Jeffords and I had to respond and rescue him out of Healy Creek. He was freezing to death.
Costales was treated at the hospital for frostbite and returned to California. Trooper Ellison says Costales came back to Alaska in February for a court appearance related to illegal hunting activity, for which he is also facing charges.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for nearly 60 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. CrowleyAlaska.com.
A reminder from the Alaska Energy Authority. The 2012 Commercial Energy Audit Program application period ends Wednesday, March 28th at 4:30 p.m. Owners of eligible commercial buildings throughout Alaska, including nonprofits, may be reimbursed for a qualifying energy audit. Go to akenergyauthority.org to apply online. Energy efficiency is good for business. This message sponsored by the Alaska Energy Authority.
The bones of a killer whale recovered from Khrushchev Island last year will soon be on display at the Sitka Sound Science Center. Volunteers and scientists spent last week re-articulating the orca skeleton. KCAW's Ed Ronco has more.
Last year at this time, Shannon Atkinson was standing on a beach some 10 miles west of Sitka with a team of scientists and volunteers. They were working against a rising tide to recover the bones of a young killer whale that had washed up dead just a few weeks before. She explained then that the skeleton would be transported back to Sitka.
At which point we'll freeze it and then we'll take the rest of the meat off. But the more we can get off now, the less we have to carry. So it's actually out of convenience that we're doing this.
Atkinson is a professor in the School of Fisheries and Ocean Science for the University of Alaska. And today, she's still standing near those bones.
Four seems a little low and a little poking out, and five seems just about right at the top, but then a little too far in down here.
But a year later, the smell of rotting whale meat has been replaced by the smell of glue. The dirty, wet bones are now pristine and dry. And instead of lying in the rapidly flooding intertidal zone of Kruzoff Island, the skeleton's components are lined up on tables inside the Sitka Sound Science Center.
So this is the first rib bone, which is also his clavicle. And if you look, there is a bony growth coming out here. And this had to have happened in utero. This is not the result of a broken bone.
As the team has worked with the bones over the last year, they've noticed irregularities just like that. Those help tell the whale's story. One of the biggest surprises was the sternum, which has made it difficult to put the rib cage back together.
So part of our challenge is to try and keep it lined up, knowing that this whale was very asymmetrical in his sternum. And part of the challenge is because he has a broken sternum just on this one side here.
Atkinson says the broken sternum is likely the result of a fight with another animal, but probably wasn't the cause of death. Scientists believe that was the result of an infection in the whale's abdominal cavity. Keeping the ribcage lined up at the moment is partly the duty of Elena Avery, an AmeriCorps volunteer who's been working with the bones for months. Avery has a biology background, but today her work sort of entails physics. She's standing underneath the partially assembled skeleton. One of her eyes is closed, and she's staring at two pieces of twine that are weighted down and hanging off the backbone.
So I am looking down those two plumb lines, making sure that I only see one, so I know they're in line, and that the sternum is in line with those two strings.
So you're not wincing or anything?
No, I'm not in pain, though I might after standing here for another however long it takes.
Luckily for her, they're moving quickly. 3 days into the job, the backbone and several of the ribs are already reassembled. And just 1 week ago, all of the bones were being photographed and scanned for inclusion in a digital library. And that is the other component of this story. If you're in Sitka, you'll be able to visit the skeleton in person, but eventually, you'll be able to see it anywhere you can get an internet connection. Robert Schlater is holding up one of the whale's caudal vertebrae. That's one of the bones that makes up the tail. He gives it a quick once-over with a toothbrush and positions it on a piece of foam in front of a rectangular scanner that's slightly larger than a computer tower. Schlater says the data gathered here through these three-dimensional scans and through standard photography will become part of a project called VZAP. That stands for the Virtual Zoarchaeology of the Arctic Project.
Which is a online, three-dimensional and two-dimensional osteological comparative collection for fish, birds, and mammals for the northern latitudes.
In other words, a visual database of bones from animals across the entire Arctic.
We've got things ranging from sea mammals all the way to fish with birds thrown in. And so you can actually look at different types of animals. You can look at the difference between a shrew femur and a fox femur and a squirrel femur, because they're all there.
That's really handy for scientists in the field who need to figure out what they're looking at.
And what we found out was that there are a lot of people who are interested in looking at bones, not just archaeologists, not just faunal analysts, that you've got kids up in little tiny villages up in northern Alaska, in this case specifically Barrow, that are using our online comparative collection every day, every week.
When the orca from Kruzoff Island finally appears in the collection, it will be from the combination of millions of pieces of data. Photographs of each bone will be combined with tiny little points detected by the laser scanner. It will take a few weeks to get it all together, but when it's done, the whale, now called Kruzoff, will be one more resource for scientists, students, and you. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
This past weekend in Bethel, hundreds of people flooded the high school for the Chamai Dance Festival. The annual festival brings in dance groups from around the region, state, and the country. Concession stands served plenty of nachos, candy, and soda. But for those who wanted a little more homemade flavor, there was the free Chamai dinner. From member station KYUK, Mark Earhart reports.
Pots and pans clank as volunteers dish up homemade entrees and sides at the Chamai potluck. Elders have been waiting patiently to fill their plates. Carl, from Napakiak, sits down to his own plate.
I'm going to have a fish, a goo duck, I think it's spaghetti, and soup.
Elders were the first to line up in the makeshift cafeteria set up in the Lower Kuskokwim School District's district office building. They are followed by the dancers performing at Chamai and then the general public. Chamai co-coordinator Carol Ann Willard says the potluck relies on donated food and time to get all the people fed. She expects 700 to 800 people to come through the line in just 3 hours.
We've gotten, I can't even put a number on it. We've got a lot of fish and dry fish and baked salmon and just all sorts of stuff. And we're still expecting more food.
Back in the kitchen, volunteers from the Tundra Women's Coalition and the Tundra Center dash about and reheat donated moose heart soup and mix up macaroni with meat sauce. But up front, people are all smiles.
My name is Terry K. Annabelle. I have macaroni and a fish and a bread and the juice and a little bit of soup, you know. I'm too full now, you know.
Anvil and the others sitting on folding chairs clean their plates. Many go back for seconds or another piece of fry bread. It wouldn't be possible, though, without the volunteers serving and preparing the food.
I enjoy what I do here. I like when the people come through, it makes it all worth it. So when the serving starts, it's all worth it.
In Bethel, I'm Mark Earhart.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Casey Kelly in Juneau, Lorian Nettleton in Talkeetna, Jennifer Canfield in Kodiak, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ed Ronco in Sitka, and Mark Earhart in Bethel. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
And by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the Trans-Alaska Pipeline with over 700 employees. Alaska Housing Finance Corporation offers loans tailored for first-time home buyers, plus home choice education seminars that can help determine if a mortgage would be less than rent. There's more information at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation.
The Association of Alaska School Boards believes in investing in early childhood development. It can produce great dividends for kids and our state. More information at aasb.org. This message sponsored by the Association of Alaska School Boards.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.